They want the names of every individual Iraqi soldier working with us, even though I won't know that until just prior to launch. Jocko just nodded, realizing that I needed a vent. He knew I was a capable and already proven leader. He had trained and mentored me for the past year to prepare me for the rigors of combat operations and then unleashed me to lead Charlie Platoon on the battlefield. But he also knew I needed to see the importance of pushing information up the chain, beyond my platoon and task unit. I needed to understand how to lead up the chain of command and why it was important. The amount of information we had to gather and the required paperwork we were forced to submit just to get approval for each combat mission was staggering. It wasn't what people saw in war movies or television shows. Never in my boyhood dreams of battlefield glory had I envisioned such things would be required, but it was the reality. We know our combat operations are making an impact on the battlefield here. They are important, said Jocko. I nodded in agreement. Jocko continued, but all of these operations need the CO's approval. He has to be comfortable with what we are doing, and we need his support to get additional approvals from higher up the chain. So we can complain about this all day and do nothing, or we can push the necessary information up the chain so that the CO is comfortable and gives us approval. Jocko had a point. The CO and his staff were not here with us in Ramadi. They couldn't fully understand or appreciate the efforts we had made at risk mitigation and the excellent working relationships we had built with the U.S. Army and Marine battalions and companies that supported us with QRFs. We can't expect them to be mind readers, Jocko said. The only way they are going to get this information is from what we pass to them, the reports we write, the phone calls we make, and we obviously aren't doing a good enough job if they still have major questions. Well, they should come out here then, I responded. They should, Jocko answered. But have we told them they should or schedule a convoy to pick them up? I know I haven't, Jocko admitted. This contradicted popular thinking. Typically, the frontline troops wanted senior leaders as far away as possible to avoid questions or scrutiny on the smallest things like grooming standards and whether or not our camp was squared away. We are here. We are on the ground. We need to push situational awareness up the chain, Jocko said. If they have questions, it is our fault for not properly communicating the information they need. We have to lead them. They are in charge of us, I questioned. How can we lead them? This epiphany had come to Jocko in examining his own frustrations up the chain. Leadership doesn't just flow down the chain of command, but up as well, he said. We have to own everything in our world. That's what extreme ownership is all about. I nodded, coming around to his logic. Jocko's guidance had not yet steered me wrong in the year we had worked together. He had taught me to be the combat leader I needed to be, but this was a whole new attitude, a completely different mindset from anything I had seen or been taught. Instead of blaming others, instead of complaining about the boss's questions, I had to take ownership of the problem and lead. This included the leaders above me in our chain of command. We need to look at ourselves and see what we can do better, Jocko continued. We have to write more detailed reports that help them understand what we are doing and why we are making the decisions we are making. We have to communicate more openly in calls. When they have questions, we need to immediately get them whatever information they need so that they understand what is happening out here. I now understood. Far from simply trying to overburden us with questions, our CEO and his staff were working hard to get the information they needed so that they could approve our plans, forward them up the chain for further approval, and enable us to launch on combat missions to get after the enemy. I needed to check my negative attitude, which was corrosive and ultimately only hampered our ability to operate. I now accepted Jocko's challenge full on. You're right, I said. I can bitch about their questions and scrutiny all I want, but at the end of the day, it gets us no closer to getting our operations approved. If I get them the information they need and put the CO in his comfort zone with what we're doing, we are going to be much more effective getting our ops approved, which will enable us to inflict greater damage on the bad guys and win. Exactly, Jocko said. From that day forward, we began a campaign of leading up the chain of command. We provided extremely detailed mission planning documents and post-operational reports. We pushed the understanding of this to our team leaders within the platoon. We invited the CO, our command master chief, and other staff to visit us in Ramadi and offer to take them along on combat missions. Our Command Master Chief accompanied us on several missions. The more information we passed, the more our CEO and staff understood what we were trying to accomplish. He better appreciated our detailed planning efforts, how we coordinated our quick reaction forces, and the substantial lengths to which we went to mitigate the risks. The CEO grew more comfortable with our combat operations. He and his staff developed trust in us. As a result, all the combat missions we submitted received approval, which allowed Charlie Batoon and Task Unit Bruiser to deliver huge impact on the battlefield. Principal, leading up the chain. If your boss isn't making a decision in a timely manner or providing necessary support for you and your team, don't blame the boss. First, blame yourself. Examine what you can do to better convey the critical information for decisions to be made and support allocated. Leading up the chain of command requires tactful engagement with the immediate boss, or in military terms, higher headquarters, to obtain the decisions and support necessary to enable your team to accomplish its mission and ultimately win. To do this, a leader must push situational awareness up the chain of command. Leading up the chain takes much more savvy and skill than leading down the chain. Leading up, the leader cannot fall back on his or her positional authority. Instead, the subordinate leader must use influence, experience, knowledge, communication, and maintain the highest professionalism. While pushing to make your superior understand what you need, you must also realize that your boss must allocate limited assets and make decisions with a bigger picture in mind. You and your team may not represent the priority effort at that particular time, or perhaps the senior leadership has chosen a different direction. Have the humility to understand and accept this. One of the most important jobs of any leader is to support your own boss, your immediate leadership. In any chain of command, the leadership must always present a united front to the troops. A public display of discontent or disagreement with the chain of command undermines the authority of leaders at all levels. This is catastrophic to the performance of any organization. As a leader, if you don't understand why decisions are being made, requests denied, or support allocated elsewhere, you must ask those questions up the chain. Then, once understood, you can pass that understanding down to your team. Leaders in any chain of command will not always agree, but at the end of the day, once the debate on a particular course of action is over and the boss has made a decision, even if that decision is one you argued against, you must execute the plan as if it were your own. When leading up the chain of command, use caution and respect. But remember, if your leader is not giving the support you need, don't blame him or her. Instead, re-examine what you can do to better clarify, educate, influence, or convince that person to give you what you need in order to win. The major factors to be aware of when leading up and down the chain of command are these. Take responsibility for leading everyone in your world, subordinates and superiors alike. If someone isn't doing what you want or need them to do, look in the mirror first and determine what you can do to better enable this. Don't ask your leader what you should do. Tell them what you're going to do. Application to business. Corporate doesn't understand what's going on out here, said the field manager. Whatever experience those guys had in the field from years ago, they have long forgotten. They just don't get what we are dealing with, and their questions and second guessing prevents me and my team from getting the job done. The infamous they. I was on a visit to a client company's field leadership team, the frontline troops that executed the company's mission. This was where the rubber met the road. All the corporate capital initiatives, strategic planning sessions, and allocated resources were geared to support this team here on the ground. How the frontline troops executed the mission would ultimately mean success or failure for the entire company. The field manager's team was geographically separated from their corporate headquarters, located hundreds of miles away. He was clearly frustrated. The field manager had a job to do, and he was angry at the questions and scrutiny from afar. For every task his team undertook, he was required to submit substantial paperwork. In his mind, it made for a lot more work than necessary and detracted from the team's focus and ability to execute. I listened and allowed him to vent for several minutes. I've been in your shoes, I said. I used to get frustrated as hell at my chain of command when we were in Iraq. They would scrutinize our plans, ask questions that seemed stupid, and load on a massive paperwork requirement that I had to submit both prior to and after every operation. You had to deal with that as a Navy SEAL at war? Asked the field manager, surprised. I wouldn't have guessed that. I absolutely did, I said. Before every combat mission, we had to get approval up the chain of command at least two levels from a faraway boss who didn't fully understand what we were up against. That required me putting the intricate details of the operation in a multitude of PowerPoint slides and then an additional Word document of several typed pages just to get approval. Once approved and we launched, then I had to generate even more paperwork when we got back. A multi-slide storyboard brief with photographs and a detailed multi-page operational summary. If we killed any bad guys on a combat mission, which in Ramadi was virtually every operation, we had to provide sworn statements describing precisely what happened and how our actions complied with the rules of engagement for each enemy fighter killed. And that doesn't even include the pages of required intelligence paperwork we had to compile. I didn't figure you guys would have to deal with such stuff, said the field manager. No matter how big or bureaucratic your company seems, I said, it pales in comparison to the gargantuan U.S. military bureaucracy. And imagine how much more emotional and frustrating it is for us when our lives are on the line every day. I often work myself into a rage over some very similar issues to yours here. But we had two choices, I said. Throw our hands up in frustration and do nothing, or figure out how to most effectively operate within the constraints required of us. We chose the latter. Let me ask you a question, I continued. Do you think the company's senior executives at corporate headquarters want you to fail? The field manager looked puzzled. He had clearly never considered the question. Could they be scheming about how to make your job more difficult? How they can keep you and your team flustered with questions, scrutiny, and paperwork, or how they might totally sabotage your mission? I asked. Of course this wasn't the case. Having worked with the company's executive team, I knew they were a smart bunch of driven, eager overachievers who wanted their frontline troops to not only accomplish the mission, but to eclipse all competitors and set the standard for the industry. No, they don't want me to fail, admitted the field manager. All right, I said. Then if they are asking questions, criticizing your plan, and requiring paperwork, it means they are in need of some critical information. When Jocko was my task unit commander, he had the same talk with me in Ramadi. That's what changed my mindset about this and allowed us to become more effective. What changed your mind? The field manager asked. I realized that if my chain of command had questions about my plans or needed additional information or more detailed paperwork, it was not their fault, I said. It was my fault. I knew we were making the right decisions and being careful to mitigate every risk we can control. I knew our combat operations were critical to achieving strategic victory in Ramadi. So if my boss wasn't comfortable with what I was doing, it was only because I had not clearly communicated it to him. The field manager looked at me, beginning to understand. So if they have questions, it's my fault that they didn't get the information they need? Asked the field manager. This completely contradicted his way of thinking and everything he had experienced in his leadership upbringing. That us-versus-them mentality was common to just about every level of every chain of command, whether military unit or civilian corporation. But breaking that mentality was the key to properly lead up the chain of command and radically improve the team's performance. Listen, the senior leadership at corporate headquarters wants you to succeed, I said. That's a given. It's up to you to inform them and help them understand some of the challenges you're dealing with here on the ground. If you have questions about why a specific plan or required paperwork is coming down the pipe, don't just throw up your hands in frustration. Ask those questions up the chain to clarify so that you can understand it. Provide them with constructive feedback so they can appreciate the impact those plans or requirements have on your operations. That is what extreme ownership is all about. I guess I never really thought about it like that, said the field manager. That's leading up the chain of command, I explained. The field manager came around to this realization. He accepted that he needed to do better in pushing situational awareness, information, and communication up the chain. If you think they don't fully understand the challenges you are facing here, invite your senior executives out to the field to see your team in action, I said. Over the following weeks and months, the field manager took a different tact with the senior leadership at corporate headquarters. He took the initiative to understand what specific information they needed and went overboard pushing that information to them. He also hosted the senior executives in a field visit to their frontline troops. It built camaraderie between the corporate leadership team and the field manager's operations team on the ground. The face-to-face interaction helped the senior executives understand some of the field manager's challenges, and the field manager's time with the senior executives made him realize all the more that his leaders were smart folks who wanted him to succeed. It went a long way toward breaking down the barriers that had built up between his field team and corporate headquarters. He was now ready to lead up the chain. Chapter 11. Decisiveness Amid Uncertainty. Leif Babin. Sniper Overwatch, Ramadi, Iraq. Take the shot. I've got a guy with a scoped weapon in the second story window of building 127, said Chris. This was a bit out of the ordinary. Chris Kyle, author of the book American Sniper, was Charlie Platoon's point man and lead sniper, the most experienced sniper in the platoon and one of the best in the SEAL teams. He had been nicknamed the Legend in jest on a previous deployment to Iraq. But as a driver of our sniper operations in Ramadi, he was racking up confirmed kills on enemy fighters at a rate that promised to surpass the most successful snipers in U.S. military history. What made Chris Kyle such a great sniper was not that he was the most exceptional marksman. His secret was that he practiced extreme ownership of his craft. Intimately involved in planning and scouting potential sniper overwatch positions, he put himself in the right place at the right time to maximize his effectiveness. While others might get bored and lose focus after an hour or two of staring through the reticle of their sniper scope, Chris maintained discipline and stayed vigilant. He was lucky, but more often than not, he made his luck. If Chris or any of our SEAL shooters could PID, positively identify a bad guy with a weapon committing a hostile act or determine reasonable certainty of hostile intent, they were cleared to engage. They didn't need my permission. If they asked for it, that meant reasonable certainty of hostile intent was in question. Can you PID? I asked. Just saw a dark shape of a man with a scoped weapon for a split second, Chris replied. Then he stepped back from the window and disappeared behind a curtain. Roger that, I said. What building again? I checked the battle map that labeled each building or structure in the sector with a number. All of us in this U.S. Army Brigade Task Force operation, including a half dozen different U.S. Army and Marine Corps battalions and thousands of soldiers and Marines on the ground, were operating on the same battle map, which was crucial. But matching the numbers and street names on the map to what we were seeing in front of us on the ground could be quite a challenge. Here, there were no street signs or address numbers. This was Ramadi. Amid the urban sprawl of trash-covered streets and alleyways were huge bomb craters and walls pockmarked with bullets and spray-painted with Arabic jihadist graffiti, which our interpreters translated for us, such as, "We will fight until we reach either of the two heavens, victory or martyrdom." We were here to ensure it was the latter. Ahead of a huge army force of U.S. soldiers on foot, M1 A2 Abrams main battle tanks, and M2 Bradley fighting vehicles, our SEAL platoon had foot patrolled into the area in the early morning darkness. We set up our sniper overwatch position in a two-story building a few hundred meters down the street from where a U.S. Army battalion would establish their newest combat outpost. Once again, we were deep in the heart of enemy territory. We covered the soldiers as they moved into the area on foot, accompanied by tanks and Bradleys. Now, the sun had risen, and hundreds of U.S. soldiers had arrived, clearing through the surrounding buildings. Chris and other SEAL snipers had already killed several enemy fighters maneuvering to attack. Just another day in South Central Ramadi. After every engagement, I relayed situational reports, or SITREPs, to the U.S. Army company in charge of the new combat outpost, Team Warrior of the 1st Battalion, 36 Armored Regiment, assigned to Task Force Bandit. The snipers did the bulk of the shooting. As an officer, my job wasn't to pull the trigger, but to provide command and control and coordinate with the friendly units in the area. However, the report from Chris of a guy with a scope weapon in a second-story window raised some questions. U.S. soldiers were clearing buildings just beyond the direction he was looking, and we needed to be absolutely clear as to what we were seeing. I crouched next to Chris and kept fairly low to try and prevent my head getting shot off. He held the sniper rifle steady and through his high-power scope carefully observed the window where he had last seen the dark silhouette of the man with a weapon. "You still have eyes on?" I asked Chris, meaning did he still have a visual on the potential target. "Negative," Chris responded without taking his eye from the rifle scope. Looking down the street he was observing, I could see a few hundred meters in that direction. The streets and alleyways were narrow and confusing. The maze of one- and two-story buildings blended together. Our view was partially obstructed by low-hanging power lines and the occasional palm tree or parked car. In recent weeks, enemy snipers had wreaked havoc in this area, killing a young Marine and an Army soldier and critically wounding more. Ryan Jobe had been shot only a couple of blocks down the street from our position. Mark Lee had been killed just a few houses down from the building we now occupied. Their loss was devastating, and this fight was extremely personal to us. We did our utmost to eliminate every enemy fighter to ensure more of our teammates and our U.S. Army and Marine Corps brothers-in-arms came home alive. Killing an enemy sniper who had likely killed our own would exact some measure of vengeance and protect American lives. But there were friendlies, U.S. soldiers, throughout this area, so we had to be sure. I got on the radio, the company communications net, and requested Team Warrior's company commander. He was a respected leader and an outstanding soldier I had come to admire in the months we had worked together. "Warrior, this is Red Bull," I said when he came up on the net. "We saw a man with a scoped weapon in the second story of Building 127. Can you confirm you don't have any personnel in that building?" I listened as he contacted his platoon commander, responsible for the buildings in that area, on the company net. The platoon commander soon answered that they did not. "Negative," the company commander replied via radio to my inquiry. "We don't have anyone in that building. His soldiers had cleared through that area an hour or so before." "Request you engage," said the company commander. His platoon commander had confirmed that none of his guys were in Building 127. Therefore, the man Chris had seen must be an insurgent sniper. And because the threat of enemy snipers was significant, the company commander, like me, wanted our SEAL snipers to take out any enemy snipers before they could kill Warrior's troops. But Chris obviously didn't feel good about the situation, and I certainly didn't either. There were a lot of friendlies in the vicinity, Warrior soldiers, just a block beyond where Chris had seen the individual. Chris maintained eyes on the window in question through his sniper scope and waited patiently. He knew what he was doing and needed no direction from me. "Just saw him again," said Chris. He described how, for a brief moment, the dark silhouette of an individual peered out from behind the window's curtain. Chris couldn't make out anything but the shape of a man and the faint lines of a weapon with a scope. Then, like a ghost, the man faded back into the darkness of the room, and the curtain was pulled across the window, blocking any view into the room. He couldn't PID the individual. I again called Warrior's company commander on the radio. "We just saw the individual with the scope weapon again, same location," I told him. "Roger," the company commander responded. "Take that guy out," he insisted in an exasperated tone. It was clear he was wondering, what the hell are these SEALs waiting for? An enemy sniper is a threat to my men. Kill him before he kills us. We certainly did not want any of Warrior's soldiers to get killed or wounded. We were there to prevent such attacks, and I felt the pressure to comply. Was it a bad guy, or wasn't it? I couldn't say with any certitude, but I had to make a decision. What if we don't take that shot, I thought to myself, and Warrior's soldiers get killed because we fail to act? That would be horrible. It would be a heavy burden to bear. On the other hand, I thought, what if we take this shot and it turns out to be a good guy, a U.S. soldier in that window? That outcome would be worst of all. I knew I could never live with myself if that happened. Despite the forceful pressure to comply, I had to take a step back and see the bigger picture. I remembered from my boyhood days in Texas a basic rule of firearm safety My father taught me. Know your target and what is beyond it. That made the decision all too clear. We couldn't chance taking this shot. Regardless of the pressure, I couldn't risk it. Negative, I responded to Warrior's company commander. Too many friendlies in the area, and we can't PID. I recommend you send some soldiers to re-clear that building. I didn't work for the company commander, and he didn't work for me. He couldn't order me to take the shot, and I couldn't order him to clear the building. But we had worked together before. I knew and respected him as a leader, and I knew he probably felt the same for me. He would have to trust in my judgment. I listened on the net as Warrior's company commander again called up his platoon commander to discuss my recommendation. From the tone in their voices, they were clearly not happy. What I was asking them to do, an assault on an enemy-occupied building, put their soldiers at great risk. It could very well get some of them killed. Shoot him, came the response, yet again from the company commander. Take that guy out, he said, this time more forcefully. Negative, I said sternly. Don't feel comfortable with that. I wasn't backing down, no matter the pressure to comply. The company commander's patience had worn thin. He had a hell of a lot on his plate, managing more than 100 soldiers, multiple tanks and Bradleys, as his men cleared through dozens of buildings. Responsible for the establishment of this new combat outpost deep in enemy territory, he also had to coordinate Warrior's movement with his battalion and the supporting companies. Now, all he knew was that we had reported a potential bad guy with a scoped weapon, possibly an enemy sniper, and we were asking his soldiers to leave the relative safety of the buildings they were in, run across a hostile street in broad daylight, and risk their lives because we didn't feel comfortable taking the shot. I couldn't blame the company commander for his frustration. I empathized. But Chris was one of the best snipers anywhere. He had already single-handedly accounted for dozens of enemy killed and certainly didn't need any urging from me to pull the trigger on bad guys he could PID. His level of caution signaled that I, as his SEAL platoon commander, needed to make the tough decision, the best decision I could, based on the information I had. As the situation developed, if information suddenly changed, we would still have the opportunity to engage and could do so with a clearer picture of what was actually happening. Jocko had always encouraged us to be aggressive in decision-making. But part of being decisive was knowing and understanding that some decisions, while immediately impactful, can be quickly reversed or altered. Other decisions, like shooting another human being, cannot be undone. If we waited to take this shot, we could later change course, while a decision to pull the trigger and engage this shadowy target would be final. With that in mind, I held my ground. We cannot engage, I told the company commander over the radio. I recommend you clear that building. The radio was quiet for a few moments. I'm sure the company commander bit his tongue in frustration. Then, reluctantly, he directed his platoon commander to re-clear the building. From his voice over the radio, I could tell the platoon commander was furious, but he knew he had to address the threat. He directed a squad of his soldiers to break out of the building they were in, re-clear Building 127, and search for the mysterious guy with a scoped weapon. We will cover your movement, I told the company commander. If he so much as moves, while our guys are in the open, he replied, shoot that son of a bitch. Roger, I responded. If the individual gave us even an inkling that he was hostile, Chris would take the shot. Standing next to Chris with his sniper rifle trained on the window, I had my radio headset on, ready to coordinate with Warrior soldiers. Suddenly, 10 soldiers from Warrior Company burst out of the door of a building and dashed across the street. Immediately, all became clear. Halt the clearance team and return to the cop, I directed Warrior's company commander over the net. Instantly, I recognized our error. Chris and I had been looking one block farther than we had realized. Instead of looking at the building we thought was Building 127 on our battle map, we were looking at one of the buildings where U.S. soldiers from Warrior were gathered. Though it was a mistake easily made in this urban environment, and one that happened more often than any U.S. commanders wish to admit, it could have had deadly and devastating consequences. The guy with the scoped weapon Chris had seen in the window was not an enemy sniper. It was a U.S. soldier standing back from the window with a Trigicon ACOG scope on his U.S. military-issued M16 rifle. Thank God, I thought, literally thanking God. I was grateful for Chris's initial judgment, an exceptional call not to take a shot he couldn't clearly identify. He had done exactly as he should have and notified me to ask for guidance. Others with less experience might have rushed decisions and pulled that trigger. I was thankful I had held my ground and ultimately made the right decision. Even still, it scared the hell out of me to think just how close we had come to shooting a U.S. soldier. Had we succumbed to the pressure, Chris would have put a large caliber round right into an American soldier, almost certainly killing him. As the leader in charge, regardless of who pulled the trigger, the responsibility would have been mine. Living with such a thing on my conscience would have been hell. For me, the war would have been over. There would be no choice but to turn in my trident, our SEAL warfare insignia, and hang up my combat boots. For Charlie Platoon and Task Unit Bruiser, it would have undone all the great work we accomplished, the many U.S. soldiers and Marines we had saved. All that would be meaningless had I given the order and Chris pulled the trigger. I keyed up my radio on Warriors Company Net and explained what had happened to the company commander. He, too, understood how easily a building misidentification could happen. It happened all the time. He, too, breathed a huge sigh of relief that we hadn't engaged. "I'm glad you didn't listen to me," he admitted. In the uncertainty and chaos of the battlefield, despite the pressure to take the shot, I had to act decisively. In this case, holding back my lead sniper from taking a shot on a target because we didn't have clear, positive identification. It was one of any number of combat examples from our time in Ramadi that demonstrated how critical it was for leadership to be decisive amid uncertainty. In combat, as in life, the outcome is never certain, the picture never clear. There are no guarantees of success, but in order to succeed, leaders must be comfortable under pressure and act on logic, not emotion. This is a critical component to victory. Principle. Books, movies, and television shows can never truly capture or articulate the pressure from uncertainty, chaos, and the element of unknown with which real combat leaders must contend. The combat leader almost never has the full picture or a clear and certain understanding of the enemy's actions or reactions, nor even the knowledge of the immediate consequences for momentary decisions. On the battlefield, for those immersed in the action, the first recognition of an attack might be the wicked snap and violent impact of incoming rounds, flying shards of concrete and debris, or the screams of pain from wounded comrades. Urgent questions arise. Where are they shooting from? How many are there? Are any of my men wounded? If so, how badly? Where are other friendly forces? Is it possible they are friendly forces mistakenly shooting at us? The answers are almost never immediately obvious. In some cases, the answers to who attacked and how will never be known. Regardless, leaders cannot be paralyzed by fear. That results in inaction. It is critical for leaders to act decisively amid uncertainty, to make the best decisions they can based on only the immediate information available. This realization is one of the biggest lessons learned for our generation of combat leaders, both in the SEAL teams and throughout other U.S. military branches, through the years of combat in Iraq and Afghanistan. There is no 100% right solution. The picture is never complete. Leaders must be comfortable with this and be able to make decisions promptly, then be ready to adjust those decisions quickly based on evolving situations and new information. Intelligence gathering and research are important, but they must be employed with realistic expectations and must not impede swift decision-making that is often the difference between victory and defeat. Waiting for the 100% right and certain solution leads to delay, indecision, and an inability to execute. Leaders must be prepared to make an educated guess based on previous experience, knowledge of how the enemy operates, likely outcomes, and whatever intelligence is available in the immediate moment. This incomplete picture principle is not unique to combat. It applies to virtually every aspect of our individual lives, such as personal healthcare decisions or whether or not to evacuate from the predicted path of a major storm. It particularly applies to leadership and decision-making in business. While business leaders may not generally face life or death situations, they are certainly under intense pressure. With capital at risk, markets in flux, and competitors actively working to outmaneuver opponents, professional careers and paychecks are at stake. Outcomes are never certain, success never guaranteed. Even so, business leaders must be comfortable in the chaos and act decisively amid such uncertainty. Application to business. "Which one do you believe?" Jocko asked. It was time to make a decision. But the executives didn't have an answer. There was much at stake for the company, and the outcome was far from certain. They weren't sure what to do. Jocko and I sat in a meeting room with the CEO of a successful software company and the CEO of one of the company's subsidiaries, an engineering company. Not yet 5 years from the software company's launch, the company had experienced rapid growth and exponentially increasing revenues. Much of the company's leadership and that of their engineering company were young, talented individuals driven to succeed. Jocko and I were brought in to give them the tools to lead their teams, aggressively expand their reach, and dominate the competition. The engineering company, led by a talented CEO, had already produced great results for the parent company. They had landed several lucrative contracts and rapidly established a good reputation for quality and service. Jim, the CEO of the parent company, and Darla, the CEO of the subsidiary company, were proud of the effective teams and processes they had developed. They each had recruited substantial talent from their previous companies to join their current teams. Darla had five promising senior engineers who each ran teams of half a dozen personnel or more. It had been an impressive year for Darla and her engineering company. But like any organization, there were challenges. Constant pressure from competitors' recruiting efforts trying to lure away their most talented people presented the most substantial impediment to the company's long-term success. The five senior engineers were primary targets. Companies knew that if they could convince a good senior engineer to join their firm, the engineer's team, his or her most talented players, might follow. The senior engineers were highly competitive. Rather than collaborate and support one another as the company expanded, some tried to outdo each other, hoping to position themselves for promotion ahead of their peers. Two senior engineers, Eduardo and Nigel, had built up particular animosity for each other and had become quite cutthroat. The two senior engineers constantly bickered and butted heads. They blamed each other when their own projects hit delays or ran over budget. Each criticized the other's work and passed that criticism to their CEO, Darla, to try to undermine each other. For months, Darla had done her best to quell their issues and animosity. She held conference calls and face-to-face meetings with them. Darla had even taken Eduardo and Nigel to dinner several times to help them try to bury the hatchet. But nothing seemed to work. Now, their relationship had deteriorated to a point that it had become dysfunctional and destructive to the rest of the team. Jocko and I joined an off-site meeting with the senior executives from the parent company and the subsidiary companies to deliver a presentation on leadership and teamwork. During the off-site, Darla's two senior engineers' headbutting reached crisis mode. She received an email from Eduardo that stated he could no longer work with Nigel and insisted that Nigel be fired. Eduardo also mentioned a rumor that Nigel had met with a recruiter from another company and was considering leaving. Shortly thereafter, Darla received an email from Nigel saying that he had caught wind that Eduardo had discussed a possible move to another company with some of his team. Not to be outdone, Nigel insisted that he could no longer work with Eduardo and that Eduardo must be fired. Darla showed the emails to Jim, the parent company CEO, during a break in the offsite schedule. The two CEOs, Jim and Darla, asked Jocko and me for our thoughts on the dilemma with the two engineers. Darla was frustrated and nervous as to how the situation might play out. Concerned about a potential mass exodus, much of the technical knowledge on current projects could be lost. That would mean missed deadlines and degradation in quality and services. It might cost Darla's company future contracts. When Jocko asked, "Which one do you believe?" Jim just listened quietly, waiting for Darla's input. "I'm not sure which one, or if I believe either," Darla finally responded. "But this could get bad very quickly. Losing either one of them and some of their key folks would be painful for us. Losing both of them and key members of their teams could be devastating. Not exactly a position of strength to negotiate from, Jim added. Does anything in their contract prevent them from leaving and taking people with them? Jocko asked. Nothing that will hold up, said Jim. As hot as this industry is right now, people won't sign non-competes. No one likes to be locked down. How good are their teams? I asked. Surprisingly good, despite all this drama, Darla replied. And how loyal are the teams to Eduardo and Nigel? Jocko asked. Hard to tell, said Darla, but there are no real diehard fans in either group, from what I have seen. The break was over, and the offside agenda started again. Strategic discussions took place, but Darla wasn't engaged. She was clearly frustrated by the drama within her team. With so much at stake, she seemed uncertain and unclear on what to do about it. When the next break in the leadership offside came, again, Jim, Darla, Jocko, and I assembled in a meeting room to discuss options. I think I just better let this play its course, Darla stated. She had decided not to decide. What makes you say that? I asked. In the SEAL teams, we taught our leaders to act decisively amid chaos. Jocko had taught me that as a leader, my default setting should be aggressive, proactive rather than reactive. This was critical to the success of any team. Instead of letting the situation dictate our decisions, we must dictate the situation.